Welcome to Talking Biotech, the podcast dedicated to exploring the latest advancements in biotechnology, sponsored by Calabra, the R&D software that accelerates scientific discovery with AI. Each week, we'll dive into the latest innovations and discoveries with industry leaders and pioneers. Now, here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folta.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's Talking Biotech podcast by Calabra. Now, one of the big themes that's been going on for the last 8 years, maybe, in this podcast series has been the CAR T cell, or the chimeric antigen receptor. I forgot what the T stands for, but but the idea is that these are cells that are genetically engineered to, or the T cells. Oh, this, of course, it's a CAR T cell. And they're T cells, which are cells of the immune system, which actively seek and destroy invaders or problems or whatever. And the idea came about that could we actually program a T cell to identify cancers or cells that were expressing aberrant surface antigens that were the signatures of problems? And this has been deployed in many different contexts. And we've talked about it on the podcast, cancer, but also in repairing scar tissue. So a lot of places where this technology is finding a home. But there are some drawbacks and limitations, and we'll talk about those today when we talk to the CEO of Emojis. But before we do that, we have a co-host today, Donald Kuhn. Donald, how's it going?
Very good, thank you.
Happy to talk to you in Paris.
Yes.
So I know you from University of Florida. We've had a lot of great conversations and other interaction, but tell me a little bit about what you're studying here at the university.
Yes, so I'm working with crop modeling, specifically for indoor and greenhouse production of food crops. So looking at how can we better predict and manage these environments for improved resource and improved food output.
Yeah, and so what is your big interest in science communication? That's the big question.
Yeah, so my big interest is just getting out there. And since, you know, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the concepts of agriculture and reaching out to the public, there's a lot of different ways people can perceive these systems. So I like to be out there and communicating about those, especially as we push to more indoor, highly controlled and highly technical environments that can utilize a lot of biotechnology.
Yeah, well, it's the biotechnology, but just the technology in general. I mean, People saying, well, you're using chemicals in that solution, and I don't want any chemicals in my food. And so are there actually any palpable pushbacks against things like vertical farming, or are they generally pretty well accepted?
No, there's palpable pushbacks to the unnaturalness of trying to think, is that really good food then? So these are things that you can noticeably track when you get consumer acceptance, but a little bit of education goes a long way in reversing that.
Well, especially because there's so much soil worship, and I know I'm going to get hate mail for this, but you know, soil is just the matrix that supports the nutrition of the system. And you know, here in Florida, we grow in sand, so it's, you know, it really is a hydroponic system that we're growing in, essentially. Well, thanks, Donald. That's you know, wish you best in everything going forward, and thank you for joining me today on the podcast. Here we go. So, we're speaking with Andy Schoenberg, and he's the CEO of Emojis. So, welcome to the podcast, Andrew.
Thank you. Great, delighted to be here, and really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and you know, describe what we're doing for your audience.
Yeah, this is pretty cool, and the audience needs to hear this because we've done a dozen podcasts on CAR T-cell therapies, whether it's been in animals or in humans or whatever, and really even more with immunotherapy in general. So can we start there? At a very fundamental level, what is immunotherapy, and why does it have such an important place in our current medical spotlight?
So immunotherapy is a way of essentially activating your immune system to attack a cancer that you might have. And the way to think about it is that traditionally, the way we have thought about treating cancer is that cancer is something to be poisoned. And what's very difficult is that cancer looks very much like your own self. So poisoning cancer is very hard to do without at some level also poisoning the other cells in your body. But the way our bodies are constructed, we have an immune system, and our immune system has an entire setup to recognize very subtle changes of a normal cell to becoming a malignant cell. And so the goal of immune therapy is in cases where somehow cancer has figured out a way around that recognition, is to reteach your immune system what a cancerous cell looks like and then have it eradicate that cancer.
Oh, very cool. And then that's where really CAR T cell therapy comes in. And I've been in love with the story for a long time. We've talked about it quite a bit. But what are CAR T cells and how are they currently being used in different therapies?
So start with T cells. So T cells are the cell in your body that actually identifies and kills tumor cells. And the way that T cells recognize it is through something called an antigen receptor. And the one on T cells is called the T cell receptor. So T cells recognize tumor cells through the T cell receptor complex. But when tumors, any type of cancer is able to actually grow and expand, and it's probably worth thinking that, hey, we are all at some level a sea of cells that could actually be tumor cells at any moment in time. And your immune system is constantly there surveying these cells and killing off the ones that are most likely or that look like they're on that road to transformation. So that by the time somebody has a cancer, it has figured out some way to evade or overgrow the usual immune response that's in place. And so T cells in your body all the time are looking for evidence of cancer and killing the cancer cells through the T cell receptor. So when cancers escape, we have to find another way for them to recognize tumor cells. And so what we do is we make a gene for something called a chimeric antigen receptor, or CAR, and we transfer that gene into T cells, and that provides now a new synthetic or artificial way for them to recognize and kill tumor cells. And that, in essence, is what CAR T cell therapy is. It's finding some way to put this gene for this new synthetic receptor that we use to reprogram a T cell to recognize a tumor cell and attack those tumor cells really, really aggressively.
Yeah, yeah. So then what are some of the limitations of this approach?
Well, I would say, if you look at where it has been most effective, it's in blood malignancies. And the reason for that has been that the first generations of CAR T cells are very aggressive. And if you have a blood malignancy, usually, if you think about your blood, it's composed of red blood cells, white blood cells, and many different types of white blood cells. Usually only one type, even a subtype of those white blood cells is what's responsible for a blood cancer. So I can reprogram a T cell to kill off that type of blood cell without really harming any of the rest of your body. So it really has to do with the specificity of the targeting we can provide on the CAR T cell. And I would say, so that's one of the reasons that it's been applied most effectively for blood cancers. And then the other real limitation of the approach has been the expense and logistical complexity. So right now, to make a CAR T cell therapy, I have to hook a patient up to a machine, isolate their T cells, ship those to a central manufacturing facility. At that central manufacturing facility, that's where the gene transfer for the CAR is done, for the chimeric antigen receptor. They then have to go back sure and make sure that everything about that cell product is in order. It's sterile. It corresponds, you know, it's been labeled right, that we make sure that the chain of identity is there and that the cells are functional before we ship it back to the patient. And then before the patient can receive those cells and have them be effective, they actually have to receive 3 days of chemotherapy. That makes space in their blood for these incoming cells to then have the opportunity to expand and kill the cancer. So it's that's an expensive process. So it takes about a month or so to execute. And generally the cost is somewhere between $350,000 to $500,000 per patient to do that. And it's patient by patient. So those are the limitations.
And so then does that process work well? Is it, you know, a beneficial treatment for those who can afford or access treatment?
It's been an incredible, as a matter of fact. So it's really transformed how we think about survival characteristics in patients with leukemias and lymphomas of various types, where we're now able to get what effectively are curative responses in patients who a decade ago would not have survived, you know, 6 months. So that's the promise of the therapy. And in fact, in many ways, these are very unique drugs. There's almost no other drug where it has this kind of efficacy, where you get these fantastic curative long-term remissions but we can't actually make it for every patient who could benefit. So right now, the estimates are that about one in every five patients who could benefit from a CAR T-cell therapy is able to receive it. And that's for a number of reasons. Some of these are geography. They're not located very, very close to major medical centers where these can be delivered. It's logistics of just that we can't make it in time to benefit them. And in some cases, it's cost. So a number of factors contribute.
Well, you mentioned this in blood cancers, but what about with solid tumors?
So there's been some recent successes, and solid tumors are different. So with a liquid tumor, the tumor cells are freely accessible. They don't actually have an opportunity to protect themselves from immune surveillance. So there's always, you know, an opportunity for a T cell to find a blood cancer cell in the blood or in other aspects of the what's called interstitial fluid or sort of the fluid compartments of your body. Solid tumors are derived from surfaces and organs, and they can build a little house for themselves to protect themselves from T cells. And what they do is they can find ways to exclude T cells. They can create an environment where T cells don't function well. So it's been more challenging to create CAR T cells that can aggressively attack a solid tumor. But we are making progress. And I think maybe what I would point to that's, in my mind, one of the most impressive studies is one that came out just this March in New England Journal of Medicine, where they have three patients that had a very aggressive type of brain cancer, where CAR Ts were able to create really impressive remissions. And the limitation encountered was when they ran out of T cells, the tumors recurred. But it's incredibly promising to be able to generate CAR T cell products that are now able to move the needle in solid tumors. So in the future, I do think and there's a lot of activity here too in academic medical centers, in biotechnology companies to try to find ways to make CAR T cells more effective. So certainly an exciting direction for the future.
Yeah, I really love the story. I think it's so fantastic. But one big subtext that I've seen since the beginning of this discussion, and I think the first time I was introduced to this may have been on the 60 Minutes special with respect to glioblastomas. And there's a lot of heterogeneity from patient to patient, that some patients, this works spectacularly. Other ones, just not at all. And what's going on there? Is it just like the genetic background of the patient or the evolution of the tumor? Or is it just maybe the way that different groups are administering this kind of therapy?
Well, I would say maybe yes to all three right now. A lot of the studies for solid tumors are being done in academic medical centers, so they all do things a little bit differently. There's no doubt that patient background is an important factor. It could be the amount of in some patients, if they've been through multiple rounds of pretreatment. One of the things people don't realize is chemotherapy does kill tumor cells, but it kills tumor cells because they are cells that tend to be growing more than other cells in your body. That's also true of immune cells. So when you get chemotherapy, you're killing your tumor, but you're also damaging your immune system. And one of the reasons that patients who go through multiple lines of chemotherapy eventually become very difficult to treat is, in part, you've selected aggressive tumor cells, but also in part, you've so damaged their immune system, you don't have any of that background help. And even for patients receiving chemotherapy, the immune system is helping in those chemotherapy responses. So any of those factors might contribute to why we've had if you engineer a T cell that's no longer functional, it's really hard then to generate the potency you need. So you are starting to see this with immunotherapy. You may be aware, right? We started with some of these what are called checkpoint inhibitors, things like Keytruda, in later stage patients. And what they're finding is now if they give those before any other treatment, that's when they work best. And I do think you're going to gradually see a shift in cancer therapy, where you see more and more immunotherapy applied early when the immune system is still working well, and that chemotherapy is reserved for later lines of when we have really nothing else. Right now, it's almost a tragedy. We use chemotherapy up front. It does generate responses, but you also damage the immune system and you hinder the ability of immunotherapy to be effective. But that's changing, right? I mean, you also want to, we have to be cognizant. We want to offer patients therapies we know work. And we're just now getting to the point where we're building those data sets, and we can be certain that when we tell a patient, hey, you should get immunotherapy first, we actually have data to back it up.
Well, it's great that we don't have to think about just threading the needle anymore, that there's some other opportunities here. That's fantastic. So we're speaking with Dr. Andy Scherenberg. He's the CEO of Umoja. What does Umoja mean?
So Umoja is a Swahili word for unity or bringing together. And it was actually coined by one of our co-founders. So we were founded, we're only about 4 years old. We were founded by myself Mike Jensen. So Mike is a pioneer in CAR T-cell technology. He actually founded a company called Juno prior to this, which is one of the companies that has developed a commercial CAR T-cell product. And a third colleague, Phil Lau. Phil's a scientist at Purdue University, along with a chemical engineer, Ryan Christman. So Ryan's he's our chief technology officer. He's in charge of taking all of the fancy science that the rest of us think up and making sure that we can actually manufacture it and deliver drug products to patients. And so when we were founded, we were looking back at a decade of fantastic efficacy of CAR T cells and seeing a number of things, challenges. And so the idea of Emoja was, man, if you're going to solve all these problems, you need the right technology, the right people, the right part. There's a lot of things you got to bring together. So that was kind of the ethos behind the company's name.
Oh, very good. I had to ask because
everybody does.
No, I really
and
do.
It really does. It reflects a lot. You see that actually in the way, and this is probably true of every drug development. I don't know how much you talk to drug developers. It's a team game. You need so many really smart people with diverse backgrounds and expertise, and everybody has to work together effectively. You have to be unified. There's no question about it. And it's one of the really great aspects of being in biotechnology as an industry is that everybody knows at the end of their work is a patient, and it does make a difference in how people think about things, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And finding the right partners to work with, you know, outside your company and all that stuff makes such a difference. We're covering that more and more as we look more in the business end of biotech inside the podcast. So we're up against a break. We really set the table beautifully for us to introduce your technology and how you do things a little bit differently to make our CAR T cells happen a little bit better. So this is the Talking Biotech Podcast by Calabra, and we'll be back in just a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Calabra, the data monitoring platform designed to reveal research insights and streamline reporting across your organization. With Calabra, you'll gain a comprehensive view of your research workflows, simplifying scientific IP governance, compliance, and analysis. Visit Calabra.app to learn how you can transform your research process today. Calabra.app.
Calabra.
And now we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast. We're speaking with Dr. Andy Scherenberg. He's the CEO of Emoja, and we're talking about new frontiers in CAR T cell therapy. So this is essentially taking something that's been working kind of well with some significant limitations and finding some clever ways around them. And that's what we'll talk about in part two of today's podcast. So in the beginning, you talked about this idea of having a patient have to go through chemotherapy before they could receive a CAR T cell therapy and how that really starts to affect the efficacy of downstream treatments, especially from traditional chemotherapies. So what is the idea behind lymphodepletion, and why is this a necessary step before a traditional CAR T cell therapy could be delivered?
It's really based on just observations that were made over the course of developing what I would say are these ex vivo immunotherapies. And it dates back to work that was done where people were taking T cells out of tumors, trying to expand those T cells and put them back in the patients. And what they observed was that the T cells just didn't survive very long. And so at some point, somebody had the idea, well, maybe if, and I think it might have actually been an observation where a patient received a course of chemotherapy and then immediately got T cells, and all of a sudden they survived a lot better. And that led to the idea, well, wait, why don't, maybe it's something to do with the way the chemotherapy is actually killing off or eliminating the host immune system prior to these cells being brought from outside. So they started to do that as a routine manipulation for any type of what's called an adoptive T cell transfer. So tumor infiltrating lymphocytes or TIL therapies were the first type of those that were pioneered. And then CAR T cell therapies came along and people made the same observation. If you just expand T cells outside the body and you put a CAR in them and you give them back, they don't survive very long, not much happens. But if you add a lymphodepletion step to remove the endogenous immune cells, then all of a sudden they seem to do better. And the concept that's evolved is that by removing the endogenous immune cells, you're freeing up access to a number of growth-promoting cytokines, growth factors, hormones, and things like that that support the expansion and survival of these of the engineered cells when you bring them into the patient's body. So that's where the concept came from, and that's an integral part of every single commercial CAR T cell product through the present time.
Then that is how we are currently doing this. And you with Umoja is representing a new kind of method for manufacturing and producing these T cells in vivo production. So what is that, and how does it help get over these hurdles with the ex vivo production?
Yeah. So, and this actually comes back to why the company was formed. So one of the things that we wanted to address when we formed Umoja was access, right? You know, if you look at the geographical and limitations, right? If you're really sick, traveling 5 hours to get a CAR T cell therapy is no picnic. And the same thing, if you look at the logistical needs of a hospital to deliver these, you have to have pretty sophisticated people, right? Apheresis procedures are not trivial. Managing the effects of lymphodepletion when you remove all lymphocytes by killing them off with chemotherapy, it increases the acuity of care. Patients are susceptible to infection. They don't feel very good. So there's a lot of things that it creates in terms of care needs that are not easy to manage at anywhere but larger medical centers. So when we were looking at, all right, what fundamentally needs to be done to really simplify delivery of that mechanism of action? Like, the question is, well, why can't we, if we formed CAR T cells in the patient's body, why couldn't they just expand and why couldn't the manufacturing effectively occur within the patient, allow them to make their own CAR T cell therapy? Because all the time, right, when we're responding to viral infections, we are making our own T cell therapies for those viral infections. The T cells expand beautifully. They don't require lymphodepletion or other manipulations. So we began exploring ways to develop drug products that would allow us to transfer a gene to T cells in vivo and prime those T cells to believe they were part of an immune response. And then once they believe they're part of an immune response and they express a chimeric antigen receptor, they should then expand in the same way that T cells naturally do. So what we developed was a technology where we have a gene transfer vehicle. It's called a lentiviral vector. And it's essentially a little particle within which are a number of components plus a gene for a chimeric antigen receptor. And then on the outside of it, we put proteins or a coating that activates T cells. So when the particles are delivered to the patient, they bind to a T cell and they trick it into becoming active, thinking it's part of an immune response. And then they deliver an expression cassette for a chimeric antigen receptor or CAR. So when we deliver these drug products, they basically create a small population of activated T cells with CARs, and then those CAR T cells are able to expand actually. And when we do this in animal models, they expand against the available targets that are there, and we get beautiful expansions that look exactly like what we see with ex vivo autologous CAR T cells. So there's something unique about the biology. There's no lymphodepletion required. There's something unique about allowing things to happen in vivo that allows us to get away without lymphodepletion. We generate as many CARs as you can generate with the ex vivo response. The depth of depletion of endogenous targets looks every bit as good as what we observe with the ex vivo autologous CARs in a very similar benchmark animal model. So it's that promise, that's data that we've now been showing for about a year. It's what allowed us to have a fantastic partnership with our colleagues at AbbVie, which is a large pharmaceutical company that's really expert in clinical development of in oncology and inflammatory diseases. And it's incredibly exciting, obviously, for us at the company now to be in position. We're actually manufacturing as we speak our first what's called GMP, which is essentially a very, very meticulous way of manufacturing a drug product that will go into people. So we're manufacturing that drug product this week, and we'll file the investigational new drug application for our first product in July, and everything is on track to treat our first patient by the end of the year. But in essence, everything happens in the patient. It's a little bit like a genetic vaccination. So when you give a vaccination to a patient, you are actually activating in the patient the T cells that already exist in that patient that can recognize the pathogen. And what we're doing differently is we are essentially taking the T cells that are already there, but a small population of them, and we're genetically engineering them so they recognize a tumor cell. So we're genetically determining the specificity as opposed to using the natural specificity. But all the rest of the response, expansion and the way that the T cells behave seems to reflect the natural biology that T cells normally exhibit, which is exactly what we were hoping to see.
It's super cool. But I guess most of this has been from animal models at this point.
Yeah, you test them in a series of models, and the ones that we're testing them are actually very translationally relevant models, what we call non-human primate models, that are effectively as close as you can get to a human patient.
And I guess the other question I have, and this is just my naivety of with respect to immune stuff, I don't even know what the field's called. T cells have a half-life, don't they? And that you would have to potentially replenish this, or is this something that is a little more durable because they're engineered cells?
So, I think there's probably patient-to-patient variability here. So if you or I respond to a viral infection, we will generate memory T cells, and the half-life of that is on the order of, 5 to 7 years for those. So you'll maintain memory T cell populations for quite a long time. With engineered CAR T cells that are generated ex vivo, for the most part, most of the response and the eradication of the tumor occurs in about the first 60 days. And in patients that they have studied for long periods of time, they can find CAR T cells that are still there. It's not exactly clear whether they're actually doing much at that point in time. And the reason I say that is, usually these are treatments that have been patients who've been treated for B-cell malignancies. So the malignancy is eradicated. And then they eventually regrow the class of of blood cell called a B-cell. And you would expect if the CAR T cells were still active, they might maintain very low lineage of that type of blood cell for very long periods of time. But not most patients will recover their blood lineage. So all that to say is it looks like somewhere between 2 to 4 months of CAR T cell activity is what's required. And that's about what the commercial products are able to generate. And it looks like that's what we're able to generate. We might do a little bit better in the animal model. We see about a twofold improvement in terms of the level of CAR T immunosurveillance over, for longer periods of time. Instead of about 30 to 40 days, we see it closer to 50 to 70. So we may do better when we get into humans. But again, we have to see. It's a whole different ballgame when you go into human patients because they've had a lot broader immune experience than animal models do. Obviously, they're usually a lot older. They've also been often pretreated. So that all those things create a lot more variability in response.
Yeah, and maybe if I throw in another question here is that, and maybe I'm jumping the gun a bit, but this would seem to slam the door on metastasis if you were able to address a central tumor that maybe prone to metastasizing, that it would limit its ability to move to other places. But then also, is there a prophylactic role in this for people who may be predisposed to specific types of cancers like BRCA minus cancers that you actually could administer this lentivirus or this lentiviral therapy before there even was a tumor in place? Is that kind of realistic thinking?
It potentially in the longer term, I would say you'd want to establish a pretty clear record of safety before you would start to do anything, preventively like that. But one could imagine that if you had, and again, the other thing you have to think about is when you look at human patients, there'll be mutational signatures that you can identify that will be common across a cancer. But what we never know is whatever it is that's different about a tumor cell has to be on the surface for a T cell to recognize it. So I think what has surprised people has been how few what we call are public antigens like this, where many, many patients have them expressed on the surface of their cell in a way that we could say, hey, 40% of this tumor will have this, tumor-associated antigen that a T cell can recognize be displayed. And then I think you'd have a long time then to demonstrate that, hey, we can find that if we have a patient that, for example, is, like to your point, has a BRCA mutation and is we know they're susceptible to developing cancer, where we could do a gene transfer that we would be sure might target some of the very earliest populations. So there's a lot of biology to be studied. But to your point, conceptually, something like this could be exactly what you might do. And it will be interesting to see also, people are also exploring vaccination approaches because T cells actually have wobbly specificities. So you could also imagine vaccinating up and trying to increase the abundance of existing native T cells that have the right specificities in certain types of patients. And those things are all parts of ongoing technology development at a variety of biotechnology companies. If you're going to be a cancer patient, there's never been a better time, right? It's a little bit of a gallows humor, but there is so much activity with so much innovation that there's a lot of hope.
Yeah, so I was thinking about the sort of the bottlenecks that you mentioned with the ex vivo production of CAR T cells. And I was wondering, you know, this in vivo, is there a bottleneck or something that's slowing down the production for the lentiviral component of it?
I mean, the bottleneck is expertise in manufacturing. So there's been some great articles on this is a complicated biologic, right? These particles have like 10 or more components, depending on a little bit on how you count them. And there's a limited number of people that have the experience with manufacturing them at scale and a real understanding of the biology. You need both a conceptual understanding of the biology, but also just a practical experience from trying to make them in a variety of different types of bioreactor systems that you have to understand the filters. There's just so many steps that where you have to have had played around a bit to sort of know what works. There's just very few people with that. So the bottleneck is really expertise. And that's where we're very fortunate. We have an individual who was involved in some of the very earliest lentiviral vector development that went on at Bluebird Bio, one of the first gene therapy companies. His name is Byung Ryu. Byung's been studying this kind of vector since his earliest graduate training, and so brings an irreplicable background, I think, to us. And since the other part of that is because there's a lack of experience, we actually build our own vector facility. So now we have a vector facility where we've had the opportunity to start building our own internal experience. And now we have teams that have probably run, 100 different large scale lentiviral preps at a variety of sizes. And of course, we're gathering data from that. So it allows you to gather data and begin to do predictive analyses of an understanding of, what the effect of things like media and all kinds of factors. So expertise for sure, but we're beginning to address all that. And over the past 4 years, I think we largely have addressed that. We can make at 200 liter scale, enough vector particles, it looks like, to treat at least one patient per liter, maybe two patients per liter. So a more standard scale that you would do at commercial would be 1,000 liter scale. So it's easy to do, 50 runs a year at that scale. That's 50,000 patients. That's already more than in one tiny facility than all of the bespoke autologous infrastructure is able to treat. And we would be able to do that at a cost of, cost of manufacturing about $1,000 per dose. Obviously, the drug product would have to be priced higher to reflect all of the other development costs and things like that. But the integral cost per dose is quite low.
And I love the fact that this is being scaled like this. I think it's just such a big deal in order to expand treatment and access. But one of the other thoughts on this is folks who suffer from more, I guess you call them maybe orphan cancers, but very rare cancers where there hasn't been a lot of work done on the different ways to address them therapeutically, maybe a lot more work in experimental space. But your website talks about this thing called a universal CAR tumor targeting approach. And is this a case where the lentivirus would give the T cells a whole suite of different surface protein receptors? Or is this a case where there's something that's shared amongst most tumor cells that the lentiviral approach would be able to target? You see where I'm going? Tell me about the universality.
Yeah, so a little different than both of those, but more the latter, more the former. The approach we have is based on the idea that if you had to deliver to a patient, and you had mentioned at one point that, for example, with solid tumors, one of the challenges is they're heterogeneous. Not all parts of the tumor will express, for example, a given antigen. So you could kill off every tumor cell that expressed a certain target, and that might leave a large fraction of the tumor unaddressed. So I think most people believe you're going to have to attack solid tumors by targeting more than one surface element. And so what our approach does is we have a CAR which itself actually is blind. It doesn't recognize anything. And then we have little small molecules that are two-sided. One side binds to the tumor, a target on the tumor, and the other side can be recognized by the CAR. And the concept would be to build a cocktail of these that you could infuse, and it would sort of light the tumor up, a little bit like a laser-guided missile. You just light it up. With enough of these in the cocktail, all the parts of the tumor would light up, and the CARs would know where to go and what to kill. And the idea it would be is that would actually be very affordable. You only have one expensive biologic to deliver. That's this universal, what we call a tag CAR. But the small molecule cocktail is actually very simple to develop because individually themselves, they're benign. They're completely inert. You can infuse them in any of us. Nothing happens. It's only when you pair them with the CAR T cell and there's a cancer in place that they accumulate in a significant level and generate CAR T cell activation. So that's the concept, and we'll be beginning to read some data out later this year on a first generation of that technology. But that is something we remain very excited about and see as an important part of the future of the company for sure.
And maybe part of this question about the business side. I mean, the company has to make money, but when you have a therapy that works, that you give it as a one and done solution. Does that work? How can this be a sustainable thing for a company to continue to grow and innovate when they're only able to sell a drug once, for instance?
Well, with there's no shortage of incidence of cancer every year. So I think for that type of an indication, it's we're in a different place than, for example, our colleagues who are in the rare disease space. In rare diseases, your point's well taken. You have a relatively small number of patients. If you treat them and it's a one-time gene therapy and they're cured, that's something we as a society have to decide how to reimburse. But for cancer therapies, actually one and done therapies, if we charge a reasonable amount, we can actually deliver them at scale, create impactful therapies, be a company that is revenue positive and hopefully continues to innovate and create benefits for more patients in the future. So I see lots of room. If you look at, for example, checkpoint inhibitors, other types of immunotherapy, they're given on an ongoing basis. So the cost per year is actually very high. It leaves a lot of room for a therapy like ours to still be something that we can charge adequately for, run our company, continue to innovate and create future products that are even better. So to your point, you have to be able to thread the needle on both the business and the science. And that, in essence, is my job. I do feel like that's a place. I'm a founder CEO, so I'm a scientific founder of the company as well as the CEO. And I do think that's one of the places where a founder CEO has an advantage is a really deep knowledge of the science. I have had to develop now, obviously, a much more sophisticated understanding of the business and how to articulate our value proposition to investors and things like that. That's the challenge. But I think after 4 years, I'm finally starting to get to where I'm able to both be deep into the science and be able to then translate my understanding of the science effectively to the investor community so that they can understand that, yes, I can create great products and a return on investment for them, which is at the end of the day has to be the case or everything, then your company goes out of business. So
what are the timelines on approaches like this? And, what are the possibilities for, people who are in need of these therapies, possibly benefiting from them in the future?
Yeah. So we were founded about 4 years ago. So we'll fire our first investigational new drug application in July and then begin to treat patients end of the year. So the timeline, that's, I think, not an uncommon timeline. About 4 years or so from kind of idea conception to being able to get into the clinic. And it's one of the mantras at Emoja was brought to us by our chief operating officer, David Fontana. So David was part of the development team for Breyanzi. It's one of the commercial CAR T cell products. And one of the things he says over and over is patients are waiting. So we know that. It's on everybody's mind all the time. On the other hand, we also need to comply with, regulatory and I would say, the highest level of rigor and ethical standards in how we manufacture and develop products. So it's always a balance of those things. So we're going as fast as we can. If we are, if we continue to execute well, and again, we're manufacturing our product now, we'll dose patients. By the end of 25, we would have a data set that ideally, if things were perfect and it looked really good, we would be able to take that data set, go to the FDA and say, we would like to run a registrational trial. So that registrational trial would be a larger patient set to make sure that what we observed in the first small number of patients was something that we would observe in a larger patient population. And ideally, with that registrational trial, we would potentially have something that would be a product as early as 2028. That's the time frame, I think, that's probably most reasonable. And obviously, we're going to try to do that over and over. There are efforts at the FDA as well to recognize that once you have a platform, one drug from a platform forward, that can grease the wheels for doing things more rapidly because you understand the platform and some of the risks are understood. You don't have to repeat every single study. So I think we'd be optimistic that you know, future products would be ones we could execute on even more rapidly as we gain more knowledge and the FDA gains and patients and doctors gain more comfort with what we're doing.
Yeah, that was really my question. My next question was about the regulatory appetite to, you know, still maintain rigor, but because of the need for this, because patients are waiting, you know, speeding that up. And you know, I've got a student whose father is currently receiving CAR T cell therapies, and you know, my heart goes out to her. I mean, he's my age, you know, and it's one of these things that you just, you know, you see this affects people everywhere, and the new therapy 100%. Seems so promising. You know, I would love to see these things happen faster, but they got to be done right, I guess. So that's the issue.
And the FDA, honestly, they are great to work with on. They get it, right? That they have friends and family who are in the same boat, and they work really well with us to you know, in terms of trying to strike that balance. And I couldn't say more, you know, more not good things about them, about the way we interact with regulators from that respect. Everybody's trying to do the right thing because we all know people who could benefit.
This is all really promising and super exciting. So if people wanted to learn more about what's happening at Umoja and follow the progress, where would they look on social media or on the World Wide Web?
Sure. So we have, you know, our website's a great place to start. www.umoja-biopharma.com. So there's a fair amount of information there. We're active on social media. You'll see us post on LinkedIn and X. As well, with you know, both updates from the standpoint of science, as well as background information on CAR T cells, and sometimes highlighting progress by, you know, ourselves or others in the space. And then location wise, if there's folks out there that are interested in working for us and love the field, we have a site in Seattle. That's where a lot of our discovery work is done, and then our manufacturing facility and laboratory building in Colorado. So we call the Colorado building the CLIMB for Colorado Laboratory and Innovative Manufacturing Building. And we have the Ski Center for Seattle Knowledge and Innovation Center. So there's definitely an outdoor ethos to our company as well. A lot of activity going on weekends that we all hear about frequently. So,
well, where are you in Colorado?
We're near in the Louisville area, which is just outside of Boulder. We have a manufacturing facility there. It's like I said, huge asset for us now with the amount of expertise and data that we're generating in there, just on the aspect of how you manufacture this type of product at scale.
Now, maybe this is a silly question, but did you say, rather than being in like the traditional centers of biotech hubs where everybody else is, did you kind of either throw a dart at the map, or did you say, where do we really want to work, where we can go do something else, have a great quality of life along with a good job?
You know, it was more spontaneous. I would say I'm from Seattle, so I was an academic position at Seattle Children's. That's where Mike Jensen was an academic position. So the natural gravity, you know, kind of center of gravity of the company when we were founded was in Seattle. And when we brought in, when Ryan Christman was looking, so Ryan had worked at Juno in the Seattle area. It was back in Boulder. He actually was a graduate student there in the chemical engineering department. We were looking at places to build manufacturing, and Seattle is not inexpensive. And so we happened to find a really, you know, I would place what we thought was a place we could build affordably in that area, and in a place where there's a lot of talent. CU has a great chemi department. There's been a history of a number of other manufacturing plants, in particular viral vector manufacturing plants, and that allowed us to recruit what we thought was a great team. And it just seemed to make sense at the time from a economic standpoint, and here we are.
Oh, very good. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. Really appreciate the story, and make me a quick promise that you guys will keep going fast. And when you have the next big breakthrough, could you join us again and talk to us about it?
100%. Happy to. And we never forget, patients are waiting. You said it really well there, Kevin.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Andy Scherenberg with Umoja. Thank you very much for joining us. And for those listening, share this story, share this podcast, write a review on iTunes. Most importantly, make sure you're telling other people about what this is and innovative ways in which we're addressing the issues of different types of cancers, including solid tumors, which previously may have been very hard to treat, and doing this by basically sharpening a tool that's already very good and making this even more universal and more applicable to other cancers. So thank you for listening. This is the Talking Biotech Podcast, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to Talking Biotech, sponsored by Calabra, the platform that bridges the gap between siloed research tools. With Calabra's electronic lab notebook, scientists can work together in real time, sharing data and insights with ease. Revolutionize your research collaboration. Sign up for a demo today at calabra.app, calabra.app.